Chapter 4. The Shillane. The Shillane sighed. She probably told the ship captain to sail more slowly just to torment me. Will she ever arrive? Her complaint fell on unsympathetic ears. She noticed Fenner's attempt to hide the roll of her eyes up into her head. Her handmaiden possessed a bubbly temperament that did not tolerate fretting and frowning, unless Fenner was doing the fretting and frowning. The Shillane felt quite sure Fenner thought her ridiculous for her darker moods.
"Really, Shillane, what could your mother possibly say that we don't already know? He is kingly, he is handsome, he is kind. He is overcome with a desire to meet you, to dance and talk and woo.
But he is Ogmerian, Fenner. Women there are slaves and are given no more notice than dogs. I sent him one of my veils as a token, hoping he might respond and reveal somewhat of his character. What if he doesn't understand it or despises it?
What's to despise? And what's to understand, for that matter, other than that you wish him to return the attention?
But don't you see, Fenner? How could he understand? The idea of giving and getting attention is foreign to him. Anyhow, I thought sending the veil was terribly symbolic. He is to be the first man to see me unveiled after all.
Come, Shillane, Fenner said. Surely those in charge of his education taught him the customs and ways of the nations he is to rule. He has agreed, has he not, to be married in the Rugothian fashion. That shows some understanding at least. Besides, look at that fine tapestry. Does the proud, handsome man there appear so stupid as to not understand the meaning of a young lady's token?
The Shillane no longer needed to look at it. The artistic rendition of her and her husband-to-be hung embroidered into a tapestry above the head of her bed, etched into her mind by hours of staring and dreaming. Woven over 100 years before her birth, the artist had imagined her bold yet delicate, and him fierce yet handsome, treading hand in hand across a bloody battlefield of fiends, demons, and monsters. She carried the reincarnation of God in her pregnant belly. He carried a sword shining white, and on his brow was the prophetic birthmark, the veiled moon of Triss. In the tapestry, all three moons shone, sharing the sky with the sun. But that was the future. Eldaloth, the god whom Mikik slew, veiled Triss at his death, eclipsing it to block the magical power that emanated from it. Mikik weakened as the moon waned, for in Triss was his might and his power. The pure men and prelates taught that Mikik had for years afterward wandered Kihal, sowing what seeds of evil and malice he could in his dissolution. Eldaloth would return and end him with finality. He would return through the Shillane. At that day, Triss would shine again, for in Triss was Eldaloth's power as well, and the power her husband would wield in protection of the infant and his mother. It was the power that would bind broken Kihal together again. She studied the tapestry for a moment, fixing the image in her mind's eye, striving to think of herself as the woman portrayed there, strong, confident, and fully trusting the man at her side. She hoped Shatan was half the man the tapestry portrayed him to be. She hoped she could be half the woman. His part seemed the most difficult, to rule, to lead, and to fight. Her role was little more than what women had done through all ages of time.
"It is just a tapestry, Fenner. The artist was no prophet. My hair is certainly not black, and if I am that much shorter than he is, he will be a tower of a man indeed.
All I am saying," Fenner argued as she weaved a thin braid into her own brown hair, "is that you are the most fortunate of women. You will marry the Haulrik. What better man could there possibly be than the saviour of Kihal? The rest of your sex must root through the rascals and rakes of this world and hope to sniff out a good one."
"And how does Kimdan smell?"
the Shillane teased. Fenner had doted on the son of Regent Ogbeth, high protector of Rugoth, ever since the first mother had called her into service as the Shillane's handmaiden 3 years ago. Fenner blushed.
"He is pleasant to the nose, though if his own were not pointed skyward so often, he might chance to notice me. So you see, I envy your position. How can the Haulrik not spend all his days daydreaming about the most beautiful woman in the world? And how could Kimdan, unless he is uninterested in womankind, not dream of you? I've seen the way men gawk at you.
Whatever beauty I have was deliberately bred into me. What you possess is a gift.
Your beauty would make Kimdan wild with passion, no matter how self-absorbed he is. My gift isn't even enough to elicit a warm greeting from him.
The Shalane moved to sit by her handmaiden on the bed, commandeering the task of braiding her hair. Fenner's carefree nature in the face of the Shalane's troubles evaporated at thoughts of her own, and the Shalane could not stand to see her friend so out of spirits, even if she thought it a little selfish.
To comfort you, then, I suppose I should confess how I envy you.
And in what way could divine beauty incarnate envy me?
I envy your uncertainty, don't you see? At least you get to play the game. My beauty may drive men mad, but what use is it? I don't get to do it. My rutted road lies before me thoroughly planned and predicted, with no chance to wander or wonder. I will marry Shatan and have his child. That is all. I may have the assurance of a good husband, but you will have the satisfaction of winning the man you choose. We will surely both find happiness in the man we love, but your journey will be more interesting and satisfying than mine.
I thank you for your comfort, Shalane, Fenner said, inspecting the completed braid. I just hope I can get Kimdan's attention without stooping to throwing myself at him. But throw myself I will if it comes to it.
That's better, the Shalane smiled. But if it doesn't work out, I assure you there are other eligible men about.
The Shalane pointed to her door, indicating her day protector, Dacen, who was standing guard outside.
Dacen is a gorgeous man, Fenner whispered, but I am settled upon Kimdan. I cannot keep my mind off of him. Besides, Dacen is 8 years my senior.
8 years is nothing, the Shalane whispered back.
She herself fought mightily not to be infatuated with her dark-haired, gregarious protector.
He is also intelligent, sensitive. A prince of Tolnor.
Do stop. I shall think you have designs on him.
But isn't it about time for—
A knock at the door interrupted Fenner's sentence, and she swore.
I am trapped again.
The Shalane laughed quietly and replaced her veil.
Come.
Dacen, handsome and smiling, opened the door and greeted them. After letting Prelate Obelard inside, he entered himself and gathered chairs for the plump churchman and the ladies. While a kind enough man, the Shalane and Fenner found the prelate a terrible bore and more than a little fastidious. His black robes, silver moon medallion, and darkly stained walnut staff marked his position. He sat heavily, squeezing a smile from lips not accustomed to much upward movement.
"Shalane," he said, inclining his head, "and Miss Fairdale, I am so glad you could join us yet again."
The prelate's voice was a high, nasal monotone that managed to grate on the ears and somehow be inconsequential enough to start the mind to wandering at the same time.
"Welcome, Your Grace," Fenner returned, standing and curtsying.
"Very well. We shall begin, as always, with the recital of the prophecy. Shalane, if you would please."
The Shalane nodded, hiding her resentment of the duty. Since she could speak, this task had been laid to her every day.
"Hear the prophecy given to Pontiff Athelion II upon Bay Mountain by angelic ministrant, signalling to Eldalos children a way to hope and to prepare Kihal for the war to come. Hearken, for joy sounds in your ears. A way is prepared for God's return, to bring health, to bring happiness, to bring holiness. For decreed are their names, and fixed their course, below the moons, standing upon Kihal, in the hand of God. The Haulric, born with Triss upon his brow, shall lead them, blessed one, gatherer of nations, saviour of Kihal. The Shalane, pure, undefiled, and unmarred, divine beauty incarnate, mother of God, the hand of healing. In the Hall of Three Moons they are bound, and Triss will show her face, and in its first light God again conceived. And upon the field of death they shall walk, hand within hand. And about them the fire of war shall burn, and about them the arrows fall, and around them the blades cut, and around them demons rage. But he bears no burn, no wound. From his heart to her hand is love. From her heart to his hand is healing, without will, without spell, without sacrifice, hand in hand, strength for strength. And from her womb his child, the tabernacle of our God, and in his hand the power of Triss, to thwart the Dark One, to bind the nations to battle. But hearken and ware, a claw is set against them to bring terror, to rend the Shalane, to ruin the Blessed One. It is the Ilk, Mikik's hand, Triss upon his foot, a killer in the darkness, a might unseen, a poison to the heart of nations. And in his face a horror spoken, and at his words hearts falter. What is joined he tears in twain, whether Haulric stands he hunts, whether Shalane hides he waits. The battlefield becomes birthplace, then is foot set against brow, blessing against curse, beauty against horror, heart against hand, our God against Mikik.
She ended, and as Obalard explicated every point again and again, she thought of how the prophecy seemed incomplete in her estimation. While prelates and pure men talked of the day of joy and triumph without hesitation, the ministrant's elision of the outcome begged the question of who would lay hold of the victory. Most prophecies pronounced everything from the beginning through the end. This one left the end unrevealed. A return to paradise under Eldaloth's hand was nowhere guaranteed, and that lack of surety burdened her with a double sense of duty. She must act her part, because prophecy foreordained her to it, but she must also perform her duty strictly and well, lest the grander purpose fail and she unintentionally ruin the hopes of the world. The burden of her calling, she thought, should rightly weigh her down. She was but 16, worshipped and revered, held up and preached as an example by the same people who remonstrated her for any childish or indecent behaviour. Great expectations of happiness under Eldaloth followed her name, and when she was permitted to leave the castle to minister to the sick and afflicted, she caught a sense of her own importance. The people cheered after her and knelt as her heavily guarded wagon rolled by. While she thought such worship should instill some sense of confidence and self-worth within her, it instead made her nervous. So many counted on her, and she felt so inadequate.
"And thus we see," Obalard plodded on, "that in this perfect union of Haulric and Shalane, there will be powers unparalleled to heal and destroy. The Shalane's healing to counter Mikik's destruction. The Haulric's generative powers to counter Mikik's malcreative force."
The prelate paused, as if expecting some reaction to his brilliant statement.
"Well," he continued after getting none, "I have many other things to share with you from the treatise I am writing, but alas, I must go prepare for the return of the First Mother. We are all anxious for word of your future husband. Extraordinary times indeed."
The Shalane marvelled at how he could be so boring, even when excited. She rose.
"We thank you humbly, Your Grace. Godspeed."
The prelate did the best bow he could muster and shuffled from the room. Dacen left with him.
"Did you hear?" Fenrir exclaimed when the door was shut.
"Hear what?"
"And the bliss that the Shalane and the Haulric shall feel upon their wedding night as they engage in the blessed creation of Eldaloth's tabernacle shall foreshadow the joy the world shall feel upon his return," Fenrir quoted.
"He said that?
Weren't you listening? I was absolutely stunned. I nearly burst out laughing."
"No, I wasn't listening," the Shalane answered unashamedly. "Ever since he started writing his treatise on the prophecy, as if there weren't treatises enough on the subject, the good prelate has become even more of a bore than usual. I am disappointed I missed that little scrap of speculative doctrine, though. I wouldn't think a prelate would dwell on such particulars."
"I wouldn't either," Fenrir replied. "But such steamy conversation has put me in mind of Kimdan. I believe he and the regent are arriving soon. I beg permission to leave you until tonight."
"Of course. Good luck, Fenrir. I will expect every detail on your return."
Fenrir left, and the Shalane removed her veil and lay back on the bed. Obalard's instruction was a powerful soporific. Despite her insecurities and doubts, the Shalane felt she possessed one reason to rejoice, a reason no other Shalane before her had. She would have a husband and a lover. The Shalanes who had come before her had waited for the Haulrik to be born, and, that failing, had been mated upon their 17th birthday to men whose identities they could not know. When the pregnancy was assured, the nameless men were sent away, never to be seen by the Shalane again. After the shattering, the people of Rugoth chose the Shalanes to rule them as queens, the office later named First Mother. Every Shalane for 200 years sat upon the throne, powerful, alone, and forbidden to love, lest another child be born that could claim the title Shalane. The Shalane could only partly understand the loneliness of her predecessors, a loneliness fate or Eldaloth had spared her. The year she was born, and on the same day, the Haulrik also came into the world, bearing the mark of the unveiled moon of Triss upon his brow. He was the son of the Shadan of Ogmir, Torbrand Cairn, and an unnamed concubine who was slain soon after she gave birth, so that no other child could issue from her womb and upset the surety of prophecy. The Shalane had never seen the Haulrik, though she knew his name was Shatan, and that he likely lived as protected a life as she did. But the most important nobles and aristocracy from the three kingdoms had finally met him during the summer. Her own mother undertook the journey to assess her future son-in-law and to negotiate on behalf of Rugoth about the wedding and the transfer of power to the Haulrik at the appointed time. King Fillingrail of Tolnor also attended. The Church of the One planned a great festival and presentation for them so they could meet the Haulrik for the first time. The Shalane could not help but think that the Rugothian aristocracy was nervous that an unknown boy, one rarely seen, would, by prophetic right, take ownership of their lands and command their armies. Her mother would bring them a report. The Shalane had begged to go on the trip. She was to marry the Haulrik after all, but they had forbidden her to do so. They said they could take no chance of exposing her to the danger of a trip through two portals and the long road through Ogmir. She knew they were right, but she desperately wanted a face to go with the name, an image to dote upon and anchor her desires to. She loved to daydream about her wedding day, dancing in the Hall of Three Moons, ancient and elegant, with the most powerful man on Kihol. Upon their marriage, he would reign as High King over all, and she would sit at his side, queen and wife, until she birthed Eldaloth, and he again ruled Kihol as he had anciently. The Shalane knew her handmaiden was right. However the Shalane might miss the tortured game of love, she would have such bliss as most women would never know. She reminded herself that even with an arranged marriage, she would still need to woo him, make him feel important, support his decisions, encourage him in his manly endeavours, and comfort him tenderly at his losses. Long years of careful breeding had fashioned her the most beautiful of women. She felt confident Shatan would want her and love her better than any man had loved any woman. She could hardly wait to see what Shatan would send as a token in return, and what report her mother had for her. She hoped he would at least send a letter. To distract herself from the wait, the Shalane decided to use the walls. Long ago, magicians created the walls with which the Shalanes could divert themselves by looking magically on any vista they wished in and around Mikmir, the capital city of Rugoth. All the rooms in her bedchamber were enchanted to this purpose, and by concentrating, she could travel to the town square, the castle gardens, or the nearby hunting grounds of the regents. The people she watched could not see her, and she could not hear or interact with them, but watching the unsuspecting citizenry had taught her to have compassion and love for them, as well as shown her a number of other things she thought her mother might object to. After watching some performers in the market, she released her concentration. The images faded, and she settled on a nap to pass the time. Even this, however, she approached with trepidation. Two recurring dreams, one a converse to the other, had started the day her mother left in the spring. Every time she closed her eyes, they came, and in those dreams, she was always running. Everyone, it seemed, took her dreams seriously. And when others asked her what she dreamed of, and the prelate and the mage, Ethris, regularly did, they would have her describe what she dreamed with precise detail from start to finish. But she told no one of these latest dreams, and wouldn't until she could make better sense of them herself. For one, she hated the way Ethris stared at her with his engulfing eyes and shook his head or said, as if he somehow knew more about her dreams than she could fathom. She feared that he did, and hated it. For another, her dreams were her own. She developed a habit of saying nothing of her dreams until she had puzzled over the odd images for herself and arrived at some conclusion, but the two dreams she dreamed now were a paradox that was simple in imagery and symbolism, but contradictory enough to thwart any grasping of their meaning. The fact that they had started when her mother left gave her reason to think them special, or at least that their meaning was somehow tied to her departure. As she laid her head upon finely embroidered pillows, safe within the confines of her veiled bed, she sensed the dreams coming in a way she never had before. The images flashed in her mind before she closed her eyes, and when sleep came, she was running. The first dream started pleasantly enough. Her breath steamed from her as she sprinted down a narrow track through a stand of yellowing aspen. The damp ground smelled sickly sweet with fresh autumn rot. Leaves fell about her hair and shoulders as she moved beneath the thick trees, and at times a soft but chill breeze raised bumps on her skin. Ahead of her, the sun sank over tree-draped mountains, weak as it always was when summer ended, but friendly and inviting nonetheless. Since her mentors and masters never let her near any place so remote, wild and beautiful, she thrilled at everything she saw and smelled. The pleasantness, however, stopped just as she started to immerse herself in it. All at once, a flood of terror drowned her, suffocating her heart and her will as she negotiated the path. She would notice then that she wore a plain grey dress, tattered and stained with blood. She ached as she ran, sore and weary, to flee from someone or something behind her. She would turn her head and only catch fleeting glimpses of her pursuer. He never ran, just walked. And no matter how fast she churned her legs, he stayed effortlessly behind her, face dark within a cowl and unseen eyes boring into her body with unspeakable intentions. His clothing, a darker grey, was also bloody and torn. She could not escape him, and the dream ended with her tripping and falling. She looked up, and he stood at her muddy feet, looking down, face lost in the abyssal cowl. The whole twisted scene, a convoluted mass of beauty and horror, left her shaking, sweating, and cold. And then the next dream started. Again she was running, but through how different a scene. As before, she ran on a narrow path through a stand of aspen. What season it was, however, she could not tell, as a thick shroud of grey ash blanketed tree, meadow, and mountain. Fast-moving, roiling clouds dumped the ash in heavy flakes upon the world in a perverted mockery of winter. Ahead of her, she could see a thin strip of sky between the clouds and the horizon, and as she watched, the sun dipped into that space and cast a fierce red glow across the sky, transforming the path she travelled into a road descending into a great cauldron of blood. All about the path men lay dead, half buried in the downpour. Arrows protruded from backs, and hacked limbs lay short distances from the bodies they had been severed from. The sounds of battle and the screams of the combatants assaulted her from every side, and fell voices howled in victory. Children wept for slain fathers, women for slain husbands, before horrifying creatures of every description slunk from the woods and killed the mourners. But rather than feeling full of dread or sorrowful as the scene prompted, her heart soared with joy. Not all her steps were to run. Sometimes she skipped or twirled about, kicking up ash that never fell on or stained her beautiful gown of red and gold. She sang to herself as a girl in love does, for before her, somewhere in the distance, he waited. There was no face or name to attach the love to, but there didn't need to be. For a certainty, he waited, and while the land about her fell into destruction and despair for reasons and through powers she couldn't fathom, she cared not. Kihol and all the races and creatures that lived upon it be damned. He waited. She would come. Nothing else mattered. And that last part, the very last part, disturbed her more than the odd imagery, the relentless pursuer, or the unnamed love. Everyone entrusted with raising her had ingrained within her heart and mind an unwavering care for Kihol and its peoples. She knew that but for her and the Blessed One, the workings of Mikik would destroy the world, perhaps as the last dream depicted. She was bred to be the vessel that would prevent that from happening. The thought that she would throw aside her duty and condemn Cathal to destruction to satisfy her own yearnings disgusted her and set her to trembling. There was no sense in it. Her love for the Ha'ulric was to provide the end to war and bring peace. Her pursuer, she reasoned, was the Ilk coming to rend her. The unnamed love, she assumed, was the Ha'ulric. The results, however, were switched. Her death brought salvation. Her life and love, destruction. Perhaps, she thought, the dreams are the work of the Ilk. She woke, and the unusual power of the dreams crushed any need she felt to sleep further. She touched the walls, concentrating on the dock, hoping to find that her mother had at last arrived. Around her, the King's Blood Lake emerged into view as lifelike as if she were actually there. The early afternoon sun rippled on the waves, reflecting the watery dance on the hulls of many great ships, ships of nobles and merchants that waited in anticipation of the arrival of the Defender, the First Mother's vessel. Among the great vessels floated smaller rafts and fishing boats, and the Shalane smiled. She could see the common folk, carefree and happy, swimming and laughing and lounging around. Floating next to the Thorn, Regent Morgan's behemoth pleasure craft, was a raft packed with tan, shirtless boys in ragged pants, playing some game where they tried to throw each other off their rickety rafts into the water. The Shalane giggled, something she rarely did, at their antics. She longed to be like them, unconfined and unconcerned, but such longing only awakened a sense of impatience and dissatisfaction within her, feelings she'd tried to crush many times before. She knew she was more like the well-dressed regent's sons, Alamand and Jorik, who stood at the rails of the Thorn, observing as longingly as she was the rowdy contest below. She imagined that they, too, secretly wished they had the courage to throw aside propriety and plunge headfirst into the mess of life they were protected against. She had watched for some time when, to her delight, the Defender sailed into view. It tacked forward quickly on the stiff afternoon breeze, and before long her mother, along with several lords and ladies, debarked. Before the First Mother could step off the longboat and onto the pier, she was surrounded by aristocracy and churchmen alike, the prelate himself among the throng. Her mother spoke to them briefly and boarded her carriage. The Shalane let the walls fade. Donning a veil, she opened the door and passed through the maze to the antechamber of the Shalanes, chatting with Dacen for over an hour until her mother and her bodyguard, Cadean, came in. The Shalane couldn't help but notice the weariness on her mother's face as they embraced and made small talk about the journey.
"And what is he like, Mother? You must tell me everything."
Mirel smiled understandingly.
"I'm afraid there is not much to tell. We barely saw him, and I have several urgent meetings to attend to."
The Shalane tried to push aside the disappointment.
"And did you give him the veil I sent?"
"Of course I did, dear."
"And?"
"And what?
Did he send anything in return?"
The Shalane could barely control the desperation in her voice.
"I am afraid not. He was touched, to be sure, but the custom of a woman's token is not practiced in Ogmir."
The Shalane groaned in frustration.
"Can you at least tell me what he looks like?"
"I will, but you must promise not to pester me any more. As I said, we barely saw the Ha'ulric, and anything I say about him is conjecture, save his appearance. He is not as tall as depicted in the tapestry. He is the same height as you are. He has blonde hair and blue eyes, and wears rather expensive and somewhat ostentatious clothing."
"But what about—"
"No, Shalane, no more questions. Come, give me another hug and be content."
The Shalane hugged her mother again, not bothering to hide her dispiritedness. Her mother did not seem to notice. Dacen and Cadean bowed to the First Mother as she left, and the Shalane stood rooted in her spot in disbelief.
"Not quite enough information for you, Your Holiness?" Dacen asked, a voice not quite concealing a hint of playfulness.
The Shalane turned to face him. Dacen, son of Duke Kildan, Lord Protector of Tolnor, was the most beautiful man she had ever laid eyes on. He was refined, witty, and absolutely pleasant at every occasion. However, the most delightful thing about Dacen was that he was thoroughly Tolnorian, and at the heart of every Tolnorian she met was a foundation of honour that supported a solidity of character rarely seen in Rugothian sophistication. Why Fenna would even consider the snobby Kimdan, over Dacen baffled her. Dacen had entered the Dark Guard at 19, easily the best sword fighter at the trials. Pure man Abelard, their court librarian and historian, told her that Dacen was the youngest protector a Shalane had ever had, acquiring the honour at the age of 22. He only recently turned 24. For a year and a half, Dacen had watched over her during the day. His smiles and bright personality lifted her, and whatever flattery he could offer her, he did. The Shalane tried her best not to enjoy it. In the absence of any knowledge about the Har Ulric, the Shalane often placed Dacen in her imagination in his stead. For if the Har Ulric was to be the best of men, then it followed he would be a lot like Dacen. Of course, now she knew that unlike Dacen, the Har Ulric was blonde. Dacen had dark hair, which set off his stunning blue eyes. Blonde hair and blue eyes, however, still played well on a man's face. Jeff, a famed bard she had seen perform twice, rivaled Dacen in looks and had long hair the colour of wheat stalks at harvest time. The Shalane shook herself, realising that thinking about the excellent qualities of men besides the Har Ulric was not appropriate. She chided herself and turned back toward her quarters.
"I will be content, Dacen," the Shalane replied finally. "It is quite possible she wished to address me privately on the matter."
The Shalane hoped, rather than thought, that this was true. "If it is of any consolation," Dacen offered, "my sister Melina didn't see her husband at all until she and he stood before the Pure Man, betrothed and married on the same day. You will have several months to acquaint yourself with your betrothed before actually wedding him."
"And are they happy?"
"Who can tell? They have as much chance as any to find happiness."
"As much chance as any?" the Shalane replied, laughing. "I suppose Tolnorian nobility is used to blind marriages for political expediency. Such things went out of fashion here in Rugoth generations ago. We believe men and women more likely to find happiness if they are afforded the opportunity to know each other and end or continue the courtship based on what they find."
"Sounds dreadfully complicated to me, Your Highness," Dacen remarked. "Seems such a course of action would lead to a great deal of distraction and wasted time."
"Now you're sounding like an Ogmarian,"
the Shalane returned mirthfully. "Highness," Dacen gasped, horrified, "that is an insult indeed. Ogmarian notions of women and marriage are so benighted that to call them uncivil is grossly understating the case. The Har Ulric, however, is no doubt much different."
"I'm sure he is, Dacen, and I apologize for my remark. It was in jest. I know you hold women in the highest regard. Whatever woman you give your heart to will be fortunate indeed, whether she has the privilege of knowing you beforehand or not."
"Forgive me, Holiness. I hope I did not respond too fervently."
"Do not fret. I was teasing you, and hoping for a vehement reply."
"To what end, Holiness?" Dacen asked as they entered the maze that served as a barrier to protect the Shalane's apartments. They both knew it so well they didn't need to think about where they were going.
"My own amusement. A bit unladylike by Tolnorian standards, I imagine."
"I should hardly judge against you. You are the most perfect woman I have ever known." The Shalane blushed beneath her veil and prayed that the Har Ulric would be so forgiving and complimentary, and cut such a handsome figure in uniform.
"I thank you for your gracious compliment, however undeserved,"
the Shalane replied. Dacen ran forward in front of her and blocked the way. The Shalane stopped, startled at the earnest look on his face. "It is not undeserved, my lady." His face was pained. "You are beautiful and kind, the two best virtues to find in a woman. How am I supposed to find a woman and be satisfied when I have to compare her to you day after day? No, I am determined I must forego any thought of women and wooing while I'm in your service. You are the Shalane, the best of women. I will protect you as long as I am able to draw sword." He took her hand and kissed it. The Shalane found it hard to breathe.
"Please, Dacen," she stammered, "do not be overcome, and do not make too much of me."
She started forward again and he fell in behind her. The resumption of this normalcy helped alleviate the strange knot in her stomach.
"I have a title and a work to do. Besides those, I am just as other women, and in many respects, they're inferior. My mother is the more gifted leader, Lady Fairdale more cheerful. No, do not protest. Once I wed and bear the holy child, my beauty will fade and I will take my place with other women, and a passer-by will hardly notice me as anything out of the ordinary."
As she said it, the Shalane realized she looked forward to that anonymity a great deal, if she was ever afforded it. "Say what you will, Holiness," Dacen said, voice subdued. "You will never convince me another woman's virtues are greater than yours." The Shalane bit her lip, grateful that the door to her room was in view, and standing on the threshold was Alduina, her knight handmaiden. She had already dragged a table and chairs out into the hallway. Unlike Fenner, Lady Alduina Mores had served as the Shalane's handmaid since the Shalane was an infant. She had 5 children of her own, and some still thought she should give up the post for their sake, but since the Shalane would be married soon, she begged to remain in service until that day.
"Your Holiness," she bowed, "and Dacen, I've the table set up and ready. I so love these card games in the evening, so I apologize if I'm a bit presumptuous in my preparations."
Alduina scrunched her eyebrows together.
"But are you both quite all right?" "We are fine, Lady Morris,"
the Shalane said, attempting a light tone.
"My mother only recently returned, and I had hoped she would bear me news of my future husband. Alas, she said she found out little, so I have been a bit disappointed and out of sorts. I'm sure a game of cards will help lift my spirits."
"I am sorry, Holiness," Alduina said soothingly, "but a rousing game of cards is a good medicine for getting a man off your mind."
The Shalane didn't feel much like playing, but she set to it, hoping her mother would exit the maze and take her inside the apartments and tell her everything. But her mother never came. She contented herself with the game, noticing that Dacen was letting her win on purpose. This both annoyed and flattered her. After several games, she begged to be excused, wanting nothing more than to sleep and hope for a more informative day on the morrow.